We'll call a meeting to order. This is State Government Finance Committee meeting for Thursday, March 3rd, 2011. You have before you the minutes from yesterday, the 2nd. Would someone move those minutes? Representative Murray moves those minutes. Any additions or corrections to the minutes from yesterday? If not, all in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. And we have several presentations today, and the first one is scheduled to be the Attorney General. She was delayed and is not quite here yet. And I think that she has to leave by 10 to 9, so we got a little bit of a problem here, I think, with our scheduling. I see the humanities folks are here. Why don't you come forward, and let's take you at this point. Good morning, and welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm David O'Fallon. I'm the president of the Minnesota Humanities Center. I've been on deck since November. So if you ask me questions today that I'm not quite ready to answer, I will get back to you ASAP. But I've worked into the programs and the budget, and I'm happy to lead us through that discussion.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'd like to very quickly, because many of us are new to the Humanities Center, take you from a 5,000-foot view very quickly down to the budget and what you're getting for the investment you're making in the Humanities Center. This piece, I don't think you got it in color, Mr. Chairman and members.
That's correct.
This piece was distributed to you very briefly, and I'd like to just take you through this in short order. If you just work with me on the front page for just a moment, a couple of key statements about the Humanities Center. We have responsibility, but we don't have any authority. So people choose to work with us because they find value in what we do. So last couple of years, 80,000 people in over 200 Minnesota communities chose to work with the Humanities Center. We have to be innovative. We have to be entrepreneurial. That's the spirit I bring to this. And I'm deeply committed to having real results for the state money that's coming in, which I think we use to pretty high effectiveness. We are an education resource, both at the community level and for public education especially. And I think right now, when everybody's so concerned about where is public education going, can we make it better, what's working and what's not working, we have some programs that are data-supported that work very well indeed, and I'll get into those in just a moment. If you'd open this document to the second page, you'll see a picture of the Humanities Center. We are actually a center. That is, we have a building. And on the right-hand side of that, I guess you'll see the general flow of money. We get $500,000 for the biennium. That is our general appropriation. And we use that to do three big things. We develop our innovative education resources, and a special outcome of that has been effective closing of the achievement gap, measurable effectiveness, which I'm happy to go into more detail about. We do community-based programs, and my shorthand for that is, let's tell the great American stories. Frankly, right now, the stories that connect us and link us together in a rapidly changing, sometimes divisive public culture. I think we do that with great effectiveness. And we run a conference center. You see a picture of the conference center over there. It's the old remodeled Gillette Children's Hospital. Didn't know if that was a question for me. There's a hand raised, but no. Okay. So you can see the $500,000, and I make a comment on the left-hand side. This is the seed corn through which we leverage lots of other funding, private funding, foundations, corporations, and federal funding, as long as some of that is available. So that's what the 500K is driving.
Thank you.
And then if you'll take us to the next page, if you would, please. That gives you the general picture of the legacy funding, which I know is not the charge of this committee, Mr. Chairman and members, but I thought it'd be good to have the full picture in front of everybody, just so you know. I'd like to specifically call your attention to the closing of the Achievement Gap page, which you will see on, if you turn the page, you'll see it there, partnering to close the Achievement Gap. You can see that the legacy funding, we were told you will work with the Councils of Color, so we're working closely with them on developing new content and materials. One of the benefits of that partnership, and we are basically working with them as education partners, one of the benefits of that partnership has been development of materials and approaches to reach kids in school who are sometimes not reached, who are sometimes left out. You know the data on the achievement gap and how great it is. We've developed innovative ways of working with teachers and the communities around these schools and teachers to close the achievement gap. And that little chart on the bottom of the partnering to close the achievement gap shows one test school, and we have more. But I just want you to see this is a data-driven, results-oriented program that's beginning to take off, that in fact is working. And it's working in part because of our partnership with the Legacy Partners and the Humanities Center long history of working with educators in the community and in the schools. So that's one result. That partnering to close the achievement gap is supported by other private and corporate funders and foundation funding as well. If you'll turn the page again, you'll see a map, current and emerging partnerships, the 500 general appropriation, 250 a year, is creating a statewide resource. And I'd emphasize again, no one has to use us. You only use us because you find value added in what we do. So I'm proud of the number of schools and communities that are choosing to use the programs of the center. I just want to point your attention to what we're calling a public and community impact. 80,000 people in nearly 200 communities, and these are programs that, for example, include an Emmy Award-winning film created with people on the Iron Range to tell how the iron ore of Minnesota basically built the armaments that saved America in World War II, that won that war. And a lot of people still don't know enough about that history, but it's true. And a recent example, I grew up in Litchfield, Minnesota, a proud kid of Meeker County, just so you know that, and especially in Lytton County, but I won't go into that at this point. In Meeker County, there's a little town called Dassel. My dad used to actually have a gas station in Dassel. We kind of grew up running the small town gas stations. But in Dassel, in response to the rapidly changing community there, they're working with the Humanities Center to look more deeply into the Indian American history of that area, how that's affecting current lives. They're looking at the new Chicano Latino population that's growing up in that area and how that is affecting school and community. So they're working closely with us to have music and museum programs that bring people together, basically to talk to each other and figure out how we're going to get along, how will we live. That is one of the value added of the Humanities Center. I won't read these to you, but you can see some of the supportive statements that people have made about these programs and about the practical on-the-ground results of people figuring out how to build a stronger community and live together. And if you turn that page one more time, you see another map that shows our statewide programming, literally from the Canadian border, Mr. Chairman and members, to Iowa. And again, I would emphasize, we have responsibility to do very well. We don't have any authority. And I kind of like being in that entrepreneurial, we must respond position, and it drives us to do what we do and do it very well indeed. That's an overview of what you get for the 500K investment that the state has been wise enough and I think smart enough to give so far to the Manikin Center. I'll pause there, Mr. Chair, for comments, questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. O'Fallon, and appreciate your being here. The Attorney General is now here, so Representative Stensrud, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Fallon, I was interested in, you know, your trying to help or improve the achievement gap, and that's one of your three main goals. Do you have any information? I'm just be curious which school districts are really taking advantage of what you have to offer, or if it's everybody across all the school districts, or if it's certain, you know, like inner city schools that truly have a significant achievement gap.
Mr. O'Fallon?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Stensrud, what we have is the information on who is choosing to use us at this point. And one current example is there's a 8-district consortium kind of in the northwestern suburbs right now that has approached us to basically buy the program. We have tested this in urban, suburban, and a couple of rural schools and a charter school, and I'd be happy to share that information in more detail with you personally or with the committee staff as you would choose. Mm-hmm. So although we are in fact a statewide resource, we're not big enough to handle the whole state. So what I think we can do is be innovative and entrepreneurial, develop programs that really work, that have a real impact, and then make them available to those who could probably pick them up and bring them to scale much faster than we could.
Thank you. Representative Benson?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the change summary in the proposed governor's budget, though, for the Humanities Center. And it would appear that they've eliminated the legacy funding for the Humanities Center.
Mr. O'Fallon?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beeson, my understanding is that the governor has yet to make any legacy recommendations in the arts, cultural, and heritage side of that equation.
Okay. Very, very good. Thank you. I'm just worried about that.
Yeah.
Representative Erdahl can shed some light on this, I'm sure.
Yes, thank you, Chair Lanning and Mr. O'Fallon from Meeker County. Is correct. The governor has not given us any recommendations for that portion yet. So we are. Well, if he doesn't, we'll just figure it out on our own.
Well, thank you very much for being here and for a good, concise presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. You got out early today.
Thank you.
Secretary, Attorney General Swanson is next. Representative Murphy, you had a question?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I just have a statement that the legislature is by constitutional designation. The legislature is designated to appropriate the money for the legacy fund.
Thank you for that clarification. Welcome.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here with you today, and I appreciate your accommodating my schedule. I know it's a busy morning, and I have a State Board of Investment meeting as well at 9, so I appreciate you fitting me in and allowing me to talk about the work of the Attorney General's office. Also very much appreciate what you do as elected officials and the difficult job that you have facing you as you now grapple with a $5-point-some-billion-dollar budget deficit. You know, the Attorney General's office is the state's law firm and also represents the people of Minnesota. We represent 100 state agencies, boards, and commissions, and public officers on litigation in all courts in Minnesota, federal courts in Minnesota, the administrative agencies as well. Every official and agency that comes before you in this committee is represented by the Attorney General's office. In any given year, we have about 7,500 open litigation files, so we are a busy law office. And those can really run the gamut of cases from, you know, a slip and fall case to a major constitutional challenge. If you notice people around the Capitol don't shovel very well all the time, if somebody leaves the Capitol and they fall down, they slip and fall on the ice, and they sue the state of Minnesota, It's the Attorney General's office that defends the state in that claim. It can rise all the way to a major contested constitutional challenge. The litigation that we do is sophisticated. It involves some of the biggest private law firms in the country, frankly, not just in the state of Minnesota. And ultimately what we do is protect and save taxpayer resources through our work, and we defend and enforce the laws that you write. How do we defend and enforce your laws? Well, it's not atypical that we have constitutional challenges. In any given year, we'll have dozens of challenges to the laws that you write. And as I mentioned, that can run the gamut. In recent years, a lot of those challenges have related to your budget balancing efforts as the legislature and governor have made decisions to either on a lot or to cut back certain programs. Invariably, that results in litigation. Somebody who doesn't like the cuts will sue, and we defend those claims. To give you an example of that, right now, the last year, the legislature, you all passed pension reform legislation to eliminate the future cost of living increases for retirees or to rein those in order to deal with pension funding levels. Very quickly, some retirees filed a lawsuit against the pension funds, and we are defending that lawsuit right now in Ramsey County District Court with a summary judgment hearing coming up here at the end of March before Judge Johnson. Similarly, we defend other laws. There have been numerous challenges over the years to the sex offender laws, the civil commitment laws. For example, out of Olmsted County, we defended the constitutionality of the sex offender civil commitment laws in a case involving a predator named Travis, who had a pattern and practice of sexually offending young boys and girls. And we were able to convince the Minnesota Court of Appeals that those laws are constitutional. The challenges can run the gamut. We're defending laws you've written on making it a crime to falsely accuse the police of misconduct. I have defended in the past the governor's on allotment decisions, challenges to the concealed carry laws, you name it. By defending those constitutional challenges and defending the laws that you write, we defend your authority, the authority of the legislature, and give effect to the policy choices that you make. We also save the state taxpayer resources. At any given time, as I mentioned, we have about 7,500 open litigation files. The state is a frequent target of litigation. The state of Minnesota is viewed as a deep pocket, and so it's frequently sued. There are jurisdictions, municipalities, state governments around the country where claims come in, and frankly, government just hands the money out like candy, and it's a bad use of taxpayer resources. By defending the state of Minnesota in court, we save a lot of taxpayer resources to the tune of over $100 million a year. Give you an example of that, another 35W bridge. When the 35W bridge fell down, it could have resulted in a lot of claims against the state. You all in the legislature passed a $37 million victim fund to compensate people who would have claims against the state. Thereafter, there was litigation between the state and various private contractors and designers of the bridge. We've been defending those up and down in the courts, and so far have actually recovered affirmatively for the state $6 million, have one last case pending that'll be going to the Minnesota Supreme Court in April involving the designer of the bridge who built the bridge about 40 years ago. But by doing those kind of claims, we save the state a lot of money. In addition, by defending your decisions, we save the state a lot of money. During the on-allotment, Governor Pawlenty on-allotted a program called the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, which essentially compensates landowners who choose not to make use of their land and instead allow private individuals to come onto their land and use it. Thereafter, you and the legislature basically ratified the on-allotment, and then the legislature thereafter made additional changes to the program. Well, there were some private people who didn't like the cuts to the program, and they filed a suit against the Minnesota House of Representatives, the Minnesota Senate, various state officials to basically not only try to obtain and recover for them millions of dollars, but also to put a prior restraint on you to say that the legislature can't change that program again, to basically enjoin you. And right now we're going to be bringing a motion to dismiss in Ramsey County Court to try to have those claims dismissed. In addition, we save taxpayer dollars by taking legal action on behalf of the state against those who owe the state money, who cause damage to the state, who defraud the state. For example, we, as I mentioned, represent every agency of the government, the Department of Revenue. If it files a claim against somebody who doesn't pay their taxes or is cheating on their taxes, we would represent the Department of Revenue. Two, affirmative claims. Just last Thursday, we filed a claim against a criminal count, actually, against a care provider who billed the Minnesota Department of Human Services almost $1 million in false Medicaid billings, billing in some cases 24 hours a day, in other cases 42 hours a day, which is a pretty fast clip, and in billing when people were even in the hospital. And so we save a lot of money that way as well. Our work ultimately protects the safety and economic security of every single Minnesotan and protects the legal interests of the state of Minnesota. We enforce hundreds of laws, both on our own as well as through representing agencies. That might include consumer protection or antitrust work, charities work, and it also includes substantial assistance to rural county attorneys on public safety issues. We also represent state agencies on very serious public safety issues as well. Our office helps county attorneys on a lot of the well-known homicides in rural Minnesota that you've all heard about. For example, in Mahnomen County, I think that's a one-person county attorney office, and not too long ago there was a sheriff deputy named Christopher Dewey who responded to a scene, was tragically shot, lingered about a year, ultimately died, was about 27 years old, newly married. And our office is helping the Mahnomen County Attorney's Office prosecute that case, first-degree homicide case, because the killing of a police officer in the line of duty, very frankly, is an offense against every single Minnesotan, not just people in a particular community. So we help keep Minnesotans safe that way. Other examples in Stearns County, when John McLaughlin went into a shooting spree at Recorey High School in Cold Spring, our office helped on that case and took it all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court to make sure that the shooter was held accountable. In Freeborn County, we're helping the county attorney's office, a three-person shop involving a prosecution of a Chad Gulbertson, who was engaged in first-degree homicide in a domestic abuse situation, went in to kill an ex-girlfriend in violation of an order for protection. She was in a wheelchair because of an amputation. He ended up clobbing her in the head 18 times with a hammer, stabbing her three times. She died. And we help that county attorney's office to bring about justice for the people of Minnesota. We do the same thing in the sex offender civil commitment area, helping rural county attorneys commit some of the most dangerous sex offenders in this state, people who have very, very long and sordid sex offense histories. In Faribault, we helped the small county attorney's office not long ago commit a fellow named Kevin Cox as a sexual psychopath. He had offenses involving girls as young as 9, including his own relatives, spanning 15 years or so, and very difficult issues, and we helped the county attorney commit him as a sexual psychopath. Right now, there's a sex offender in the news, John Ryberg, who a special review board has recommended be released from civil commitment. Starting tomorrow morning, we'll have a deputy attorney general, assistant attorney general, representing the Commissioner of Human Services very strongly and aggressively opposing his release from civil commitment. It's a man with 94 victims and very, very difficult situation. And so we get involved in public safety those ways as well. Represent the Minnesota Department of Public Safety on over 5,000 revocations of drunk driver's licenses every year. Right now, we're defending some breathalyzer equipment that's used in thousands of arrests around the state for drunk driving. There's been a challenge to whether that equipment works, and we're defending not only millions of dollars in equipment, but the outcome of that case is going to ultimately affect thousands, about 4,000 drunk driving cases in Minnesota. The bottom line is we do important work that keeps Minnesota safe, that protects the legal interests of the state, and by doing that, we deliver a good bang for the buck for the people of Minnesota. I handed out some charts here and also submitted a letter. If you look at chart number one that we passed out, shows the total budget of the Attorney General's office in the left column, about $35 million total if you include all funding to the office. This calendar year 2010, we recovered checkbook cash in hand to the state over $60 million, so returning almost two times what the appropriations are in terms of recoveries, and then saved the state over $100 million additional dollars by defending lawsuits, by defending claims against the state. So you can see, you know, a lot of agencies that come before you basically are asking for money and don't necessarily return that amount to the general fund. We're doing it in spades, both saving money and bringing money actually in. If you go to chart two, it shows the reduction in funding to the Attorney General's office over the years. We have engaged in significant belt tightening over the last 10 years, a very steep drop in funding to the office. And if you go to chart three, it shows the reduction in employee count to the office. In 1998, the office had 537 employees. This right now, about 315 employees, so about a 40% drop in employees in the office over the last 10 years. And chart four compares that to state government as a whole. And I think if you look at our trends, we've had a significant decline in funding and employee levels compared to the state as a whole. And then finally, chart five, if you kind of compare the budget of the Attorney General's office, keep in mind we represent 5.1 million citizens and represent 87 counties. Compare our budget of $35 million to, for example, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, which is one county, and is $46 million, so $11 million more for one county. We're on par with Ramsey County. So that's kind of a quick preview of the office and the work that we do. I think we deliver very good bang for the buck for taxpayers. We do important legal work. It contributes to the safety, well-being, financial security of every single Minnesotan. And happy to take any questions.
Attorney General Swanson, that second slide that where you show the budget, the general fund budget from 2001 to 2011.
Mm-hmm.
If you took all funds, what's the trend line been there?
It's we also get money from some state agencies. We charge what are called partner agency contracts, where they pay us for legal services a certain number of agencies. Those have remained pretty flat over the years. We get a grant, I think it's a little over $1 million, from the federal government to prosecute Medicaid fraud. That's remained pretty flat over the years. So the additional funding above and beyond the general fund would be pretty fairly flatlined over the period.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Swanson, you say that you work with 87 counties, and you mentioned some in your... What's your chargeback fee to these counties as far as their costs, and how does it compare to other states?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman,
Attorney
Representative
General Swanson.
Anderson, thank you for the question. We do not charge the county attorneys for the services that we provide. It's been, over the years, essentially a form of some local government aid, where at the state level the office is funded, and then for these rural county attorneys that might have a handful of prosecutors on some of the most heinous crimes, we do assist them. I believe that in the civil commitment area, for example, where we help the rural county attorneys civilly commit some of the most dangerous sex offenders, I'd have to check, but I actually believe the statute may prohibit us from charging fees in that particular area. There's a state law that says we can't charge them.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Attorney General, but you do chargeback to state agencies. I've been told that, and I'm just wondering what the difference is between county, since that's a government, mm-hmm. and state, mm-hmm. which is a government agency, and why the difference?
Attorney General Swanson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I don't know historically what the difference was. We do not do chargebacks or partner agency agreements with every state agency. It's kind of an amalgam. There are some state agencies, the Department of Health, Department of Human Services, where we've entered into legal services where they compensate the office for the legal services that are performed. There are any number of other state agencies where the work that the office performs comes out of the office's general fund appropriations, and there are not charges. As I mentioned, I don't know what the impetus was when the legislature passed the law saying the office cannot charge county attorneys for the civil commitment work involving sex offenders. I'm not sure what the history was or what the impetus was for passing that law.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. So what do you charge back agencies? What is the amount that you charge for attorney fees?
Attorney General Swanson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I believe it's $114 an hour for attorneys, and that's an amount that's filed with and approved by the MMB. We kind of go through the cost and go through a process whereby they approve that amount.
Thank you.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Attorney General Swanson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
A couple of questions. First, and I'm sorry, I came in a little bit late. You may have covered this. Are there any pending lawsuits that either give us a big upside or a big downside as a state that we should be aware of? Anything pending right now where we might bring in a lot of money or we stand to lose a lot of money?
Attorney General Swanson.
Yeah, I appreciate the question, Mr. Chairman. Representative Simon, I was mentioning earlier there's about 7,500 lawsuits pending in the office at any given time, and the totality of those is, yeah, some of them can have pretty big financial impacts one way or the other. There are some pretty major lawsuits, for example, the pension funding lawsuit where we're defending the changes made by the legislature. That involves a substantial amount of money, and if the court were to not allow or to disagree with the legislation or find it unconstitutional, that could have a very big magnitude financially on the pension funds and would become a major public policy issue for you all. But, you know, a lot of the work is work that you can't always guess where litigation goes, and so we'll have to see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I was just wondering. I've been asking the same question of other agencies, too. You just never know if there's a case out there on the horizon, but thank you.
Yeah.
Another question, too, and we've been having a lot of discussion in this committee and others about comparisons between the public and private sector.
Mm-hmm.
If you can tell us, what is the starting salary for an attorney these days at the Attorney General's office, and how does that compare with the private sector?
Attorney General Swanson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, the starting salary for an assistant attorney general is about $58,000 a year. The starting salary for a new lawyer at a major law firm is probably about $110,000, $115,000 per year. Lawyers at private firms quickly go into the neighborhood of $200,000, $300,000 a year, easy, very early in their careers. And the progression rate in our office is nothing close to that. And I would point out, I mean, our competitors in our the competitors of our cases are these private law firms. When we go up against law firms on these major issues, we are dealing not just with the biggest law firms and the most qualified law firms in Minnesota, but very frankly, the most qualified in the country. It's not unusual in our cases to have multiple New York City, Wall Street firms on the other side of our cases, and we do need to fight fire with fire and be able to handle the litigation in a very competent fashion.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just another question. Mm-hmm. Do you have any, are you able to make a similar comparison with paralegals, for example, if there is such a thing as a standard starting salary and what the comparable private sector rates mm-hmm. might be or salaries might be?
Attorney General Swanson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, I don't have those figures at hand. I know that the private law firms pay more, though, for paralegals, and we can afford to pay paralegals in the office.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Attorney General Swanson. Do you see any need for changes or reform in the sex offender laws?
Attorney General Swanson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, I have concerns about the sex offender laws. I mean, I have concerns about sentencing. One of the things that I'm a fan of is actually increasing the duration of sentencing for sex offenders who are initially charged with some of these very, very heinous crimes. I think these crimes are incredibly serious and ultimately have a devastating impact on the people involved, our communities, public safety in general. I am a person who believes that we need the civil commitment program. I think that we have many, many, about 600 sex offenders who have been civilly committed to St. Peter. We need that particular program because these are dangerous individuals and we don't want to see on the streets. In addition to that, we're going to need that program in Minnesota for a very long time because even if you increase sentences as far as you possibly can, there's a tail. You have offenders who have already been incarcerated who will be coming out of prison over the course of many, many years. And as those people come out of prison, something's going to have to happen to them. And if you don't have a civil commitment program, they're going to be ending up on the streets. And we don't want them on the streets. These are very, very dangerous individuals. These predators are sexual psychopaths, and they create a real threat to public safety.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Chair Lanning. Attorney General Swanson, have you conveyed these suggestions in a legislative agenda? Is anyone bringing anything forward for you on this?
Attorney General Swanson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I would be interested in talking to you and working with you on some of these measures. We have, in the past years, absolutely worked with members of the legislature on some of these. I have communicated my interest in tougher sentences for sex offenders and would love to work with you.
Representative Erdahl.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, frankly, some years back I had my experience with a gentleman's club piece of legislation on the House floor. I'm not interested in repeating that episode, but certainly there are attorneys around here that I think would be well served to work with you on that.
Okay, appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Stenzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Attorney General. I love the chart showing a 41% reduction. I mean, you've done well with the resources you have, and I love the comparison between the 15% increase over the same time period in total state employees. It's a tremendous job in trying to work with those resources. How is your backlog? How's your bandwidth right now? Are you keeping up with what you have going? And do you have a contingency plan if you get overburdened with cases? Do you offsource? Do you outsource? And do you have contract lawyers that you could use in an instance like that?
Attorney General Swanson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you for the question. It's tough. I think the caseload in the office is about two times what it was about 15 years ago. The work of the office has increased. At the same time, the number of employees has gone down. The work has gone up a lot for a lot of the reasons I talked about. And one thing is litigation has just become a lot more contested. I mean, people duke it out and they fight and they go up and down to the various appellate courts. In addition to that, for some of the reasons I mentioned, there's just more litigation involving the state of Minnesota. That litigation has been increasingly sophisticated. And so there is a backlog of cases. There are cases that we can't bring. There are times we have to say no. If a rural county attorney comes to us and says, can you help? We cannot help in every case. We have to say not on this one. And that's unfortunate. I wish we could even do more, but we do the best with what we have. In terms of the contracting, there are cases where the state will hire, for example, on bond work, private attorneys, because you have to, the securities market require that you be red book rated in order to give an opinion that the bond markets will take to the bank. And so there will be times MMB will hire outside bond counsel. Very frankly, that tends to be an expensive way to go, though, because private lawyers charge a lot, as Representative Simon asked the question about starting lawyers. And in the private sector, there are lawyers who charge, $400, $500, $600, $700 an hour compared to our $114. And very frankly, private lawyers now charge more by hour than a lot of our citizens make in a whole week. And so that tends, in our case, not to be the greatest way to go in most cases. Thank you for the question, though. Appreciate it.
Representative Kahn.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, first let me give a little explanation about the chargeback to agencies. This is something that was done in the Attorney General's office, similar to what Representative Downey is trying to do with OET. At one point, each major department, at least, had its own attorneys, and they operated totally separately from the Attorney General's office. And we kind of stopped that and moved all those attorneys into the Attorney General's office. I wouldn't want to say that maybe there aren't any out there, but anyway, we made that one source of legal service, of legal service in the state. So.
Thank you, Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Attorney General Swanson, my question kind of follows up with Representative Erdahl, so I won't ask his over, but just to follow up, I had received some correspondence from a constituent about, and you mentioned Ryberg.
Yeah.
Is there also a Duval that you're fighting against a release on, and do you think you'll be successful in keeping both of those locked up for a long time?
Attorney General Swanson.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, Representative, the way the process essentially works is there's a special review board who reviews these particular sex offenders when they file a petition to be released from civil commitment, and the special review board is comprised, I believe by statute, of a psychologist, an attorney, not an attorney from our office, but an attorney who's hired by the Department of Human Services, a psychologist who's hired by the Department of Human Services, and a third individual. They make a recommendation in terms of whether a particular offender should be released from civil commitment. Ultimately, then, that goes to a three-judge panel appointed by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and those judges have to decide on a majority vote whether a particular offender will be released following what's called de novo review, so they look at the evidence separately from whatever recommendation came from the special review board. My understanding is there are two offenders. Ryberg is one, Duval's the other, where the special review board has recommended that they be released. My understanding is that the Commissioner of Human Services in both of those cases has objected to the release. It was actually Commissioner Ludeman, I believe, originally who objected to the release, and now Commissioner Jessen is carrying that forward. The commissioner in those cases is represented by the Attorney General's office, and I can tell you again, on John Ryberg, the offender who's up for hearing tomorrow, we're going to have a deputy attorney general and assistant attorney general there aggressively fighting the release of that individual. He's got 94 victims, a very sordid history of victims involving women who were brutally raped and has been diagnosed as a sadistic rapist according to his initial commitment. Not the kind of individual that, as Attorney General, I would want to see released. I think it's a real public safety issue for the people of Minnesota. He's had 94 victims already. I wouldn't want to see a 95th. And so we will be fighting as aggressively as possible on behalf of the Commissioner of Human Services to try to make the case to the three-judge panel that he ought not to be released.
Representative Murray?
Just a quick follow-up. Yeah. How does a review board then look at somebody that has 94 cases like that and come up with something as he should be released? I don't understand the logic at all there.
Attorney General Swanson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, neither do I. Neither do I.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Attorney General Swanson. I know, thanks to Representative Simon, we passed the False Claims Act. Was it 2 years ago or a year ago? I can't remember. And my recollection was that the intent of that was to start tapping into some federal pots of money or federal incentives for fraud detection in Medicare and Medicaid. And if you could just give us an update on that. I didn't see a big uptick in federal reimbursements to your office. Maybe the federal money doesn't actually come back to your office. But just an update on that program. Did you staff up for it? What's the success been? And is there any financial benefit to your office for that program?
Attorney General Swanson.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey. I know we did a report to the legislature in January 15th of this year. I think you required us to do annual reports, and I'll share a copy of that with you. But I think we got fewer than six complaints so far under the state False Claims Act law. There's already a federal False Claims Act law, and so we get a lot of complaints that come in. Most of them, though, have a federal component, and we've taken up that the federal share of it through working with the federal government, the OIG, other attorney generals. I believe that of the six or so we've gotten, there hasn't been one yet where we've intervened. Doesn't mean that won't change and there won't be more cases filed down the road under the State False Claims Act, but thus far there have been very, very few filed, and so far we haven't seen them filed that have been meritorious. In terms of your question, I believe that ultimately the law that passed did not allow for, I don't think we've heard back from the federal government, but if a state law meets certain criteria, the federal government will give the state a 10% spiff for bonus. And we wrote a letter to the federal government asking whether Minnesota's law qualifies for that and have not yet heard back.
Representative Simon, to this point, you had a...
Yeah.
Well, and Representative Downey, thanks for the question. I think one of the things here, too, is if you remember, we did pass it in 2009, and in fairness to the Attorney General and her office, at the time, part of the compromise was that we put in the effective date a year later.
Yeah.
So it didn't take effect until August 1st, I think, of this year.
Yeah.
And so it's probably not surprising that there aren't that many claims yet filed or inquiries made, since it's only been on the books for basically a few months here. But, I mean, we'll see what happens in the future. But just so folks know, we did pass it 2 years ago, but it probably is going to take a while to generate a lot of heat.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just to follow up then, so I can't remember, was there any staffing allocated as part of that bill, or have you kind of beefed up staff for that program that will eventually see a return on, or are you doing all of this within the existing staffing levels? I can't remember.
Attorney General Swanson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, we have not yet, because we want to see the claims come in first, but we'll staff according to the claims. I mean, fraud against the state is a serious matter, and as we've been very active in the Medicaid fraud area, I mentioned the case we charged out a week ago. There have been many others where, especially the state Medicaid program, is ripped off by care providers who are billing inappropriately, and those are serious cases, but we want to see the cases come in before we staff for it. Otherwise, we staff up, and if the cases don't materialize, then you got staff you don't need. So we'll staff according to the cases that come in.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We all think you're doing a great job. I mean, it would be hard not to look at the stats and recognize that we're sure glad that you're there and you're doing the kind of job that you are, and the folks are doing lots of work. I'm going to assume, however, that that you didn't take your job because of the salary. It's public service, and you see that. And if you're probably in a private sector, you could be making lots and lots of money, much more than you are now. My question, because this is a budget meeting, because it's been asked, it's kind of a follow-up to Representative Simon, is I've just become aware in the last couple of months that we graduate around 700 lawyers per year.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something there, but I won't speak to it.
I hear lawyer jokes all the time, believe me. I won't be offended.
No. But, you know, my question is, you're very successful, and I'm wondering whether or not, because people do take jobs for more than just money, do you feel like, because of where your wages are, that you're unable to attract the best and the brightest?
Attorney General Swanson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, it is a challenge recruiting the very best attorneys. We do everything possible to try to recruit them, and there are a lot of lawyers who believe in public service. They want to represent the people of Minnesota. They want to work on the kinds of cases that we've talked about. I've had attorneys who have taken multi-six-digit pay cuts to come to the office who have been very successful in private practice but are willing to step down from that role and do public service. At the same time, it's constantly a challenge. People have to pay their mortgages. They have to pay their car bills. And so when you look at these incredibly lucrative private sector salaries out there, it's something that's hard for people to turn down. And so even if they join public service, eventually they may feel the call of going back to that money. And so it's a hard thing for the office. We do our very best to recruit the very best so that we can fight fire with fire and do the kind of cases we're bringing. Ultimately, though, it's a tough thing, and it's a challenge.
I'm assuming, Mr. Chair, that you feel like you have a pretty competent, good staff. You have a great staff that serves you well. And I guess where I'm going with this is that sometimes you do make career changes because you know by going to your office because you are successful that ultimately at some point that's going to look good on a resume too, possibly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, absolutely.
Sure.
It sure does. Yeah, absolutely.
Right, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Members, I know we have several that have further questions. Attorney General Swanson is already late, and I understand that Secretary Ritchie also has some time constraints here. And if you don't mind, I think we need to move on. Anybody want to plead for an exception here? Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Chair Lanning. I just one brief question. You know, this is a lawsuit question, as my district has the most famous landmark is 3M.
Yeah.
I have to say that we were surprised and maybe some of us a little disappointed about the lawsuit. Can you just give us an update on the 3M lawsuit?
Yeah, sure.
Attorney General Swanson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawick, the issue, if you recall, in 2007, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency entered into a consent decree with the company in order to essentially remediate future harm from occurring. The issue that remains is past harm to the state of Minnesota through the discharge of these chemicals, PFCs, into the groundwater, into the surface water. There's about a 100-mile square area where groundwater has been contaminated, about a 12-mile square area in Washington County, where the Minnesota Department of Health has put out a special well advisory, putting limitations on the ability to drink water out of those wells. Three communities in Lake Elmo cannot even drink water out of their own homes. So, and then Lake Elmo can't even use a reserve well that they built because the plume moved and now the well is contaminated. The issue there is to try to seek recovery for past harm caused, which is different than the 2007 case. My ultimate hope is that case will still settle, that there will be a resolution. That's what we wanted to see. We had about 6 months of negotiation, and there was a December 30 deadline for filing suit. When the resolution didn't come, we had to follow the December 30 deadline. I would be hopeful, and the goal would be we can still get a resolution that's in the best interest of everyone. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Attorney General Swanson.
Thank you.
Appreciate your being here today.
Appreciate your time. Thank you.
We'll call forward Secretary of State Ritchie. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. Appreciated the opportunity just a few weeks ago to present an overview. Today I'm going to be brief and try to focus down on the financials and on the budget request that's in front of you. It'll take us a couple seconds to get hooked up here, but I appreciate your willingness to move the schedule both Attorney General Swanson and I sit on the State Board of Investment, and they're meeting right now. And we now have a quorum, so that I think we're fine over there. So I appreciate everybody's patience with our scheduling difficulties. If we're up, I just want to remind you the main components of our work. You can see it here on the next slide. Again, our major activity by far, the largest, is business services, which are for entrepreneurs, for existing companies. Consumers also use our business services to double-check often the backgrounds of companies. Second largest is elections. We're the backbone for our counties, townships, and cities. We are the state's official record keepers, and so that's a portion of our work. We run the address confidentiality program, our safe at home program, and then we have some administration and computer services. Through this work, we generate about $14 million a year that goes to the general fund, and that money comes from a variety of sources. So this is a biennium number, but again, business services, uniform commercial code fees, and this is a service we provide to businesses to help them secure liens or loans, notary fees, annual report requests, and there's a little tiny bit that comes when you or others you rent our list of voters, or when people rent our list of businesses, and filings when you or others file for office. So this is the sort of general way that we come up with $14 million each year. You give back to us about $6 million a year, and that leaves about $8 million a year as a surplus back to the general fund. And it's been fairly steady. You can see it goes up and down a little bit, but it's been pretty steady over time. So we're serving at this point about 650,000 people doing transactions every year, mostly filings, but also calls. People come into our office. We are especially aware of a very high number of people filing new businesses. This is something that we've noted, about a 20% increase in the last 4 years over the previous 4 years. This is good news in Minnesota's economy. It generates a lot of ripple effect in other sectors of our economy, but it's also creating a strong future for Minnesota's economy. So this part of our work, this roughly 60,000 people a year who come through our door or through our email system, are the folks creating new businesses and creating a new kind of future. Some of them are quite new to the process, and so they often require additional assistance or a little bit more hand-holding because they are new, but they are, you know, rapidly becoming integrated into our broader business community. So this business filing section of our operation you know, takes a little bit over half of our staff, and it's the dominant part of our budget. The second part of our work is, of course, in elections. We have our day-to-day work as the backup for all the local people who run elections. We've had three statewide recounts. We've had the largest election in state history, but we've also been bringing on a number of innovations, largely laws passed by the legislature that we've implemented. We've streamlined the process, the electronic transmission of ballots. Some of you know that we've done a lot of work to enhance the ability of our soldiers and others serving in the military to vote, online voter information for people to find out where to go vote, to track their absentee ballots, to see if they're registered properly or not, special websites for our military voters. We've also been authorized by the legislature to make use of important databases that are coming to us, available to us from other agencies, change of address. We use the corrections database, the courts, databases from Social Security, non-citizenship, etc. Lots of innovations in that area part of our work. The Safe at Home program, the record keeping. I also sit on the State Board of Investment, the State Executive Council, the Historical Society Board, the State Canvassing Board. Each of these requires a certain amount of staff time and attention to do an appropriate job, to be a responsible member of those boards for those activities. We have, as all agencies, had budget reductions every year that I've been in office, the last four, we've had reductions. Some have come through legislative action. Some have been voluntary on our part. We work closely with Commissioner Hansen and the governor to voluntarily cut staff to help meet the challenge facing the entire state. You know, there are longer-term trend lines that have the same kind of general, but the last 4 years is what I'm most familiar with, and we've had significant budget reductions in each of those years and in both the biennium. So we have done a tremendous amount of work with less money, and we use the experience that we've had, especially in automation in our business services, to help guide us into our thinking and preparation of our new budget. And as we looked into the future, there were three big things that we took into account. One is there will be increasing demand for our services. Business service filings are up 20%. We don't expect that to back down any. As the economy recovers, there will be new demand for new services. And there are new demands for information. Chambers of Commerce are getting information to help them find new members, things like that. We also know there'll be more voters next year, presidential, Senate race, every House and Senate seat in the legislature will have some school levies. Next year will be a record election in our state. And safe at home, we're now serving about 1,000 people. That's been rising each month. We will serve more people through that program in the coming biennium. So we know there'll be increased demand for our services. We also know there'll be one big special project, which is redistricting. When you complete your work on redistricting, then we will work with counties through our computer system to help them reallocate each individual voter to the new proper district. Some people, of course, won't change, but as lines are drawn in different ways, people's voter files will need to be updated. This happens once every 10 years. It's a very big project. We are making our plans for that now because we'll have to do it in a relatively short period of time. It'll have to be ready for the primary election of 2012, which now occurs in August. And third, we need to know that we are reducing our expenditures without doing cost shifting onto local governments. Our work is done primarily in partnership with county recorders in our business service side, with county auditors in our election side, city clerks, township clerks. We need to make sure that when we achieve efficiencies or when we reduce expenditures, we're not doing that simply by shifting the costs onto other people. And so those are the three things we kept in mind as we prepared a budget. So we are now moving on to how we will handle reduced cost, how we will handle that with increased business activity and with a big redistricting. I showed you this slide once before, but our main experience has been that automation can, for our office, be a real saver of time, money, staff, and will help us keep our excellent service up even with less staff. John Deere in our office, John Deere is our single biggest customer. They use our UCC filing system for a lot of their machinery sales. Over 2 years, they've gone from nearly 100% paper filings to now 100% electronic filings. Our computers talk to each other. It took a lot of work on their part of their staff and our staff to make that happen. But now that they talk to each other, they've saved a lot of money. They get a 2.5-day faster turnaround. We save money, and we've been able to redeploy staff to be available to help people who need help directly. So computers talking to each other, freeing up staff, that's core to our strategy for going forward. As we go forward, knowing we're going to have increased demand for our services, knowing we've got a big redistricting project, and knowing that we don't want to be engaged in cost shifting on, particularly on the local governments, our general fund request is flat. It's $5.659 million for each of the next 2 years. That's a flat request from before. And through this process, we believe that by continuing our investment in automation, we can continue to provide really excellent direct customer service and keep our customers happy. People who file with us, who provide the money that goes to the general fund for your use, have a choice. They can use the internet to file in Delaware, they can just choose to say some other place they will do their business. We want to make sure that they get excellent customer service and we stay technologically compatible with where they're headed. And that's built into our assumptions about our work. And by completing one of our big business services projects, our automation projects, we'll be able to shift some of our computer resources to the redistricting. That's the sort of big project that's out there that we have to pay attention to, and be able to do that relatively soon. So we will use the general fund money allocations from the legislature to do our maintenance of effort with our Help America Vote Act and to core our core operating responsibilities. We will use our funds that remain from the original grant from the Election Assistance Commission to maintain our statewide voter registration database and our core services that we provide to the counties on elections. And we will use the direct access fees. A certain portion of the fees are reserved for paying the credit card cost and for upgrades and maintenance on the business services database. Those will continue to come out of the direct access fees that are part of the fee structure. The one big change that will occur is that the temporary technology fee, which was authorized by this committee and the legislature a few years ago, will end in July, the completion of the project to do further automation. That will reduce the direct access fee collections by about $1 million a year. So the businesses who are filing in the categories where that temporary technology fee has been allocated will see about $1 million drop in their cost, and it will be $1 million less in our direct access fund. But of course, it was to complete an automation project, and that project will be critical to our ability to reduce staffing going forward to keep up our excellent service, but to do it in less money. So our reputation in the business community and the people who use our services is very high. We know that's why they continue to come to us and not go to Delaware or some other state. We want to keep that service high. We want to make sure that we have the resource to do it. And we respectfully request your support for our budget to enable us to keep that service high under this very, very difficult overall budget situation. Chairman Lanning and members, thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to any questions.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Secretary, first of all, I got a comment on the website. I've been using it for about 6 years, and it's a great website. I mean, lots of tools for the business side of your business. And regarding that, for new business filings, can you give me a sense, because I'm trying to understand the trending here, on the number of nonprofits that are being registered versus for-profits? And I'm sure you could just tell me where I should be going on the website. I can probably find it there. But do you have that figure? By the way, I have a couple of the questions right after this.
Secretary Ritchie.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidiger, I'm the very fortunate state official who has Bert Black, a national treasurer, on my staff, who's been there for 30-some years, and I will turn this question over to Bert. I think you probably know it or will know exactly how to get it.
Okay.
Mr. Black.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Leidiger. Nonprofits, we get somewhere, and I can provide you with exact figures later on, because we do track that and we do watch the trends. But the number of nonprofits is actually fairly small compared to the number of for-profit filings that we get. We get about somewhere in the neighborhood of, I think it's about 1,800 or so nonprofit corporations formed per year. And of course, corporations come and go, so
right.
The aggregate is, I think, somewhere in the 20,000s for nonprofit corporations. We also have nonprofit LLCs, but we have very few of those, literally maybe one a month, and that's only been in effect for the last 3 years. We get, the for-profit businesses come in several flavors. The main ones are corporations, and we get about 8,000 corporations a year, LLCs, and we get about Those are the most popular now. In the last 5 years, they've become the most frequent set of business filings, and that's about, I think we'll have somewhere around 24,000 this year. And then we have assumed names or trade names, which are either individuals or groups of people, sometimes corporations, doing business under a name other than their own name. Maybe they want to use it as a branding name or a marketing name or what have you. Obviously, you don't want to double count the corporations there, but we get about 18,000 assumed names every year. And so probably about 12,000 of those are businesses. So you're looking at in the neighborhood of something like over a 20-to-1 ratio of businesses, if you take all three of those, to nonprofits. So about 45,000 to about not quite 2,000.
Chairman, Representative Leidinger, or is Secretary Ritchie, did you...
Is that a substantial rise from 10 years ago?
Mr. Black?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Leidinger, the nonprofits have been pretty flat.
Okay.
Over the last, really, more than 10 years.
Okay.
Representative Leidinger.
Let me go now on to elections. The other day, I heard a figure that... that I was very concerned about, and that's the military absentee votes that came in, that come in and are counted. And my understanding is that the reason why we moved up the primary dates was to accommodate absentee voting in the services. Now, the figure that I heard was that we're only counting 5% of the military vote that's out there. And I did a little digging because, you had said that it's actually 99%. We're counting 99% of what is coming in. This 5% figure is now concerns me even more because of the little research I did. My understanding is there's 13,000 military members in the state. At any given time, there's something like 23% of them are deployed, which is about 3,500. Yet the number of votes that have come in is relatively small, 760 votes, some figure like that. That is 5% of 13,000 that's out there. Now, granted, a lot of the military people could be in state and could be voting normally as opposed to absentee voting. But if you just look at the percentage of what has come in and what has been counted on over those that have been deployed, that's only 23%. What are we doing to capture more of those deployed votes?
Secretary Ritchie.
Chairman Manning, Representative Leidinger, thank you for that question. When I was elected, we had 2,600 people mobilized in the Guard and 1,072 voted. Last year, there were 229 people mobilized and 690 people voted. So in a very short period of time, we've been able to dramatically reverse the total number of voting military and family compared to those who've been mobilized. And this has been a result of a special website, which is just for military and overseas voting, the electronic transmission of ballots, the use of the longer period of time to make sure that it's actually 99.3%, I think, were able to vote, and a lot of publicity and advertising that goes through the families of our mobilized military members. This overall problem, which is being really unable because we don't have a base in Minnesota. And so, for example, in my association for the U.S. Army chapter, the only people we have that are active duty are part of our recruitment battalion, which I sit on the advisory board for here. So we have a very small number of active duty military, but we do have a large portion of Guard that get mobilized. And so when we track our progress on reaching military and overseas voters, because they're lumped together often in the government statistics from the federal, we track who's being mobilized, how many people does that affect, and then how many are voting. And so in 2006, which was the last comparable non-presidential, We had 2,600 people mobilized then, but only 1,000 voted. Last year, we only had 229 who were mobilized at the time. We had almost 700 who voted, so that would also include some family members. So it's the kind of thing that we put a lot of attention to, and we've made great progress on. We've especially made great progress on really reducing the late ones, which aren't allowed to be counted, reducing the error rate, which was a big problem, because in the past when they had to have commanding officers or somebody cross-certify, create a lot of problems with actually getting acceptance, and in getting our number of military and overseas voters compared to those who are mobilized to go way up. So we feel like, and it's not just our opinion, the person in charge of military voting in the Pentagon has cited Minnesota as the top example of what a state can do to make significant progress on making sure folks can vote, and we feel very good about that. Surveys of international voters, overseas and military, have put Minnesota very high in also satisfaction with the information provided and with the experience itself, and so we feel very good about that. But I'm the first one to say when I came into office, this was a terrible situation, and that it has gotten a lot better, and there's a lot more that needs to be done. And I believe our future is working through the families who are actually the ones who are in contact with often younger people who are our soldiers in the active duty, and being able to use them to make sure that people are remembering the timelines, using the electronic transmission, then making sure that it can happen.
Representative Leidinger.
Just, and we can talk more about this offline, I think, but we're missing a lot. I mean, it's the active duty military, those guys that are on ships in the Navy, and it's the Air Force guys on the base. It's a straightforward task to reach the National Guard. It's a much more difficult task to reach the active duty, and that's where I think that we're falling down.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidinger, you're absolutely right, and these are sons and daughters of Minnesotans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's who these are, sons and daughters of Minnesotans who've gone into active duty, who live someplace else, and who perhaps, if they so choose, could vote in Minnesota, mm-hmm. or they can vote where they're on base, Texas or wherever. And so I would love it if they voted in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Voting on Texas and base, I mean, you know, that's a whole different question. And that's why we think working through the families is critical. You know, the Legionnaire magazine goes out to 100,000 Minnesotans to those families, the VFW newsletters, that kind of thing, and perhaps offline, but I'm really looking for additional ways that we can do outreach that isn't like huge cost, you know, like buying ads or something, but getting articles and things like that in that alert family members. Our Vote in Honor of a Veteran program last year, we had 80,000 people participating with the badges, and a lot of them were family members who said, yes, and I'm going to make sure my son or daughter, wherever they are, make sure they vote. But you're absolutely right. Those sons and daughters of our state who are now living someplace else and in active duty are going to be a different population than reaching, you know, mobilized Guard and Reserve, and we need to find family and other connections to make that successful.
Just one last, and I'll stop. Do we know the percentage? Is there any way to know the percentage of those active duty members that still list Minnesota as a record of domicile?
Secretary Ritchie?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidinger, no. Bob Carey, who's the head of voting in the Pentagon, mm-hmm. has, you know, he's come here and testified on our behalf a couple times. He has said in public presentations that they would love to find a better system, but I think they haven't in their heads, because you have that personal choice, you know, to say, I'm going to keep my parents' address as my domicile or whatever, or to list, you know, where they are. I know that the Pentagon itself would like to have better numbers, because don't necessarily make sense to everybody, because you could be double counting a whole lot of people. But so far, the Pentagon has not been able to really help us with that, or they haven't been able to themselves give us better numbers. We're trying to pay attention to the the moments when people are mobilized, when they go into the service, we want to make sure, like, we work a lot with our junior ROTC and our ROTC programs. The Army is flying me to Fort Benning on Monday to spend a day with our planning at the national level for our work with junior ROTCs and ROTCs, because if we can get those young people registered and get them as poll worker trainees in their high school moments, those sons and daughters of Minnesotans will be more likely to be voters, you know, be part of the process. So not every young man or woman going into the service is coming through a ROTC program, but the ROTC programs are an important place where they do come through, and we have really excellent programs in Minnesota. So that's one of our ideas, but I'm looking for more ideas.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. And this is something I'm extremely concerned about, to maximize the, you know, the voting opportunity for our military. Thank you.
Me too.
Thank you. We have Representative Downey and Representative Anderson, and then we need to move on. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on some information requests and a high-level discussion we had when you were here before about the HAVA funds. And first, thank you very much for your comprehensive response to our letter from the committee and the very detailed budget account spreadsheets. So I'm just, can you go back to the very beginning of the HAVA program? And all I need is a very quick snapshot of the total dollars that Minnesota received and roughly how Minnesota has deployed those dollars on kind of the statewide voter registration and election administration systems versus the equipment and the kind of the local polling items in the HAVA funding mechanism.
Secretary Ritchie.
Thank you, Chairman Lanning, Representative Downey. First, thank you for your questions, and we're preparing a supplemental letter to the overall letter, but I want to ask Beth Frazier to go through, because the kind of core numbers from the 55,000 feet level. So can you take that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members,
Frazier,
Beth
welcome.
Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. And Representative Downey, we have been compiling that information, but getting that letter and everything else has slowed it down. So I'm sorry we didn't get you the information prior to today. In total, the state has received about $50 million in HAVA funds. And the state was required to do a state match on a 1-to-19 basis. And luckily, the state was able to include about $1.7 million that had already been appropriated for voting equipment toward that. Under the Help America Vote Act, the funds, in addition to the state match, also accrue interest, and unlike, I guess, many other federal funds, the interest is required to stay with the HAVA fund. So in total, the inputs have been about $52 million. And there are two primary expenditures. One has been the development of the statewide voter registration system, and the other, the largest expenditure, was sent to the counties for the purchase of election equipment, particularly the accessible equipment so that people with disabilities could vote independently and privately. So about $32 million was sent to the counties to purchase that equipment. They were also allowed to use it to purchase optical scan voting systems. There were counties in Minnesota that, prior to the Help America Vote Act, either counted all the ballots by hand or had a central count machine. So in the precinct, you put your ballot into a ballot box, and all the ballots were taken to the county seat, where they were then fed into a machine. So a lot of counties used the funds to buy precinct counters so their voters could put it right into the machine in the polling place, which, of course, is better for voters, because if you messed up your ballot and voted for too many candidates, for example, it kicks it back to you. So those are the two primary...
How much for SBRs?
We have it split out by year here, so I can't add it really quick. I think it's about $10 million for the statewide voter registration system. But again, we will provide detailed figures on these different expenditures, but those are by far the two highest.
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair, I think I'll spare the committee a more detailed review of this, and we can wait for their information. I think the observation, and if you want to provide a brief comment back, you certainly can, but the challenge we're going to be facing, I think, is that in any kind of technology deployment, you always have about a 15% to 20% kind of annual maintenance requirement for updating the systems mm-hmm. and replacing the stuff that's broken and what have you. And it appears to me that we've, and I don't want to use pejorative terms, but we have spent or gone through the $53 million without any kind of advanced planning for the ongoing maintenance. And now I see that we've got a $1.9 million maintenance of effort requirement here at the state, and I just did some really quick math, and I think we've imposed about a $4 to $5 million per year kind of annual maintenance burden on the counties unless the state is somehow going to pick up the maintenance of that equipment that we deployed there. So anyway, I think we've got a circumstance where we have imposed some significant costs on the counties for the maintenance of this HAVA program, and we've got a funding stream that we're going to have to fund, it looks like, out of the general fund for maintenance of effort without a lot of forethought having been given to maybe putting some of that $53 million away and using it for maintenance, and maybe the program wouldn't have allowed you to do that. But anyway, I think we've got an ongoing burden here through the management of those HAVA funds that we need to think about and maybe have a little bit better plan for the long haul. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, amen. Amen. Federal government handed this down and made a mandate and created a obligation, and it's been zeroed out of their budget for the last two cycles, and our Secretaries of State Association is, you know, leaning on the Congress and the federal government, but you've hit the nail on the head in terms of a long-term problem. Election machinery is responsibility of the county, so we are sensitive to the fact that through this federal mandate now, the counties have better equipment in many cases, but they will have this obligation. Some of the HAVA money is in their maintenance accounts, and some counties have gone to other systems, but it's Representative Downey, you're absolutely right that we have to tackle this, particularly after this biennium, in a real direct way. At our last national meeting of Secretaries of State, different states talked about their strategies. You know, basically, we're one of the few states that still has funds, you know, relatively small, but we do have funds left. And there were some very creative ideas that we've been gathering more specific detail, and I'd love to continue that conversation because we need to be working with our counties in particular to figure this out going forward.
Representative Anderson, and then we need to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Ritchie, you've got a change item here for potential legal fees for the judgment that was brought against you, and I see that states that have already had similar lawsuits have won in this case. Or not, they haven't won, but the plaintiffs have won. What outside counsel did we, the state, use on behalf of the state, or did we just use our Attorney General's office to do the counseling work?
Secretary Ritchie?
Chairman Lanning, Representative Anderson, the Attorney General's office represented us, and you correctly identified that every single state lost. And Chairman Lanning has been very helpful in carrying a bill forward through the committee in that change request. It's not part of this part of the budget. And Chairman Senator Mike Perry, the counterpart on the Senate side, is carrying it as well on that side. And I believe the Attorney General's office did a really excellent job, and they won here as they won in other states.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many hours was expended in the trial? Do you know how many hours it was that was?
Chairman Lanning, Representative Anderson, I do not know, but we could easily ask the Attorney General's office. Our office also had to put quite a few hours into it, but the Attorney General's office, I can ask them and get back to you on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Secretary Ritchie, and members, we need to move on to...
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Frazier. Dr. Jolly. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Eric Jolly, president of the Science Museum of Minnesota. I appreciate your time and attention today. The Science Museum of Minnesota is before you with a request for $1.187 million in our general operating budget, and I am delighted to talk with you about where we invest that money, how it serves the state, and what I hope you will see as your return on that investment. The Science Museum of Minnesota continues to be incredibly focused on the belief that science is an essential literacy, essential on many dimensions, but clearly essential for civic participation and economic participation. The state of Minnesota is listed as being in the top 25% in job categories in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics in the nation. Top 25%. Our state is a science state, a state of science employers, and we are in the bottom 25% in the number of college degrees in those same employment areas. We have a disconnect which in a very short time could threaten the stability of our economy even more than what we're facing now, and the Science Museum of Minnesota has been working with every educational institution, K-12 through the U, to see that we can start addressing this. Research has demonstrated that if eighth graders can see themselves in a science career and that self-perception is nurtured even more than grade point average, they are more likely to become one of those 25% top employed people in this state. But we are not there yet. And so the Science Museum of Minnesota has worked very hard to drive this change through our state. We do it in a number of ways. We're the largest museum exhibit construction company in any science museum in the United States. We create exhibits to inspire young people and get them engaged. And let me say, we create exhibits for other science museums in other states that employ over 100 Minnesotans, giving us free access to the product we develop for our students in our state before we turn it over to them for their inspiration. We have created a lending library which is second to none. We, instead of having schools invest in microscopes that may be used 2 or 3 weeks in a single class, the Science Museum has aggregated the purchase, scheduled with school districts across the state, and we distribute high-quality microscopes and support systems to allow schools to use this material more efficiently, thus saving them their own budget and investment and making sense of the way in which we spend money on school supplies. We support classroom redesign, doing more teacher professional development in math and science than the university. We are the largest provider in the state. We see that teachers learn how to teach effectively and how to measure their outcomes. We're working in community centers with programs like Suitcase Science and Collector's Corners, helping to support libraries in their pursuit of a mission that will help move this state's economy forward. We are working with homeschool groups in larger numbers than ever before, growing by more than 40% in the last year. And we are partnering with business and industries. Our partnerships have allowed us to take the state's investment and do some pretty remarkable things. We've taken bits and pieces. There is no one place where we've put your $1 million. There are dozens of places. For example, our complete community school support programs expend roughly $2.4 million a year, of which $52,000 is represented from the state general operating support. But it's an essential $52,000 because we've paired our money with our own earned income, with the profit that we've made doing programs for other states. We've paired it with the fees that we charge schools. We've paired it with the sponsorship dollars of major corporations. And they are willing to say, so long as the Science Museum itself will put skin in the game, the state will step up and put skin in the game, the schools will say it has enough value to hit their bottom line and put skin in the game, then if that will happen, we'll pitch in. And we've directed major gifts from Cargill, 3M, Ecolab, and other leaders who are concerned about our state's positioning to train the next generation of scientists. We have been focused on economic development through job creation in our OmniFilms program and business, our exhibit for sale and construction business, in our work for workforce development. We do a great deal with major corporations to help them with retaining their own staff, their own research staff, to be a place where senior executives who come and say, Minnesota's the right place to be. There's something not only exciting for my family and friends, but the kind of things that will want to keep our staff here on site. We work with these organizations for recruitment and retention programs, and we work very hard for teacher effectiveness. We measure our outcomes. We aren't here to train teachers so teachers feel better. We're here to train teachers so students achieve more. If they don't, we stop the program. We're a research organization. But we're also a Minnesotan organization. And we have seen this coming economic stress. 9 months ago, I sat down with my senior staff, and we changed the direction and organizational structure of the Science Museum of Minnesota to help increase efficiency. Our redesign reduced by a third the senior staff on payroll at the Science Museum of Minnesota. We've worked to become more efficient, and we'll continue to do that. We're investing in new technologies that will help us reduce our staffing costs even more. We look to expand our lending library because it's one of the most efficient uses of state dollars to allow schools to have resources without paying individually for resources that should, in any logical system, be shared. They should have been shared 20 years ago, but at least I can tell you, they're shared now. We're proud of being a part of, we hope, the solution. We believe that the investment that you make pays off in a major way. We generate more than $39 million in economic activity from the $1 million investment of the state. We'll continue to do this as responsibly as possible, and I hope to give you the kinds of output that you want from the agencies that you invest in. The Science Museum is an independent nonprofit, and the support of this state has gone a long way in doing the kinds of things that no one else will support. We have the number one provider of teacher professional development, the number one exhibit construction company, the number one Omni film station in America, the number one film production company in any museum, because we also have a facility that's clean, well kept up, and safe. And that's the foundation on which we've built. That's what your investment has given us. Mr. Chairman, members, I thank you for your time and attention. I'm very happy to take your questions.
Questions from members. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jolly, I just have a couple questions. There's a nonprofit rate agreement in your handout, and I'm just not sure I understand it. The 43.39%, the predetermined, that's not your, nonprofits, when you say you have 10% of doing business goes to administrative costs. Is your rate 43%, or what is this?
Dr. Jolly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you. No, we're listed by the Nonprofit Council as falling at less than 10% in fundraising. So, that represents a combined figure that's in working with federal and other grants, we receive approximately 28% in what would be considered indirect costs. That's the pooled accounting cost for associated activities. In other words, if you were to look at my office or your office, it's apportioning the percentage of the mortgage, the percentage of the heat, the percentage of the water, percentage of security, the percentage of cost of accounting cutting my paycheck. They're pennies at a time. Audited by the federal government, the top figure is what the National Science Foundation assigns to the museum. We collect only 2.5%, for example, from Legacy. We don't collect 43%. We collect approximately 8% from the U.S. Department of Education when we do work on their grants, but our maximum allowed is 43%, and so we list that for you.
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up question about two of your current exhibits. King Tut is a little bit expensive, but I suppose it's gone all over the country. It's something like $14 for adults to go. We're tracking that. We're planning on going, just to say. But so how do you determine your rates for exhibits like that? And then your other one, can you tell us about your big, is it called the Big Brain? Because I work on early childhood issues, and is that was developed here, right?
Dr. Jolly?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for your questions. The King Tut exhibit is a traveling exhibit which is under the ownership of a number of organizations, including Egypt, which has proved to be an interesting negotiating partner at this present time. And the rates set are negotiated by the vendor and not by the Science Museum. The one thing I am most proud of, never in the history of King Tut's travel, and I should mention the history involves only 8 U.S. cities, and only one science museum in the United States was elected as a museum qualified by the Egyptian authorities to show Tut, and that's the Science Museum of Minnesota. That rate was negotiated with them. However, we would not take the exhibit unless they would offer us a low-income discount rate for our underserved populations, and we are the only site ever to do that. The additional money which they receive, not the Science Museum, is going towards the preservation of these antiquities and the construction of a museum in Cairo. Each of our business models for these is very different. I certainly wish it cost less to go to King Tut. My staff have to pay if they rent the headset because we don't have proprietary rights to the recorded announcements in that exhibit. However, we felt it was of sufficient value to our community to still bring it. And with the low-income ticket prices, we thought we did something really remarkable. The more remarkable exhibit is called Wonder Years, which I am thrilled with. It's an exhibit which is designed to help parents and caregivers understand developmental sequences and issues that their own children face so that they can make decisions about the kind of environment, stimulation, and educational opportunities they want to give their children. There are many parts of this exhibit which I love. One of my favorite, for example, is working with neuroscientists, opticians, and physicists. We were able to create a set of goggles which allows a parent to see in the way a child sees at different ages. Please come and put these on. At 1 month old, a child can't recognize the difference between, physically, you can't recognize generally, a relative and a complete stranger or perhaps a farm animal at more than 10 feet. Their vision is that poor. I have to confess, I had no idea. But you get to see it 2 months old, 3 months old. What kinds of stimulation then will work for a child, and what's the proximity? And why a child does want to be held close to a parent. So this teaches a lot about how children process information, what their physical limitations are, and how, as a parent, you can create an environment that will serve your child better. We don't prescribe the environment. We simply lay out the case for what children see and know, and we're very excited for this. Many programs that are now serving young people are bringing their entire staff to the Science Museum for training. We offered free admission, for example, to Way to Grow, a Minneapolis-based organization that does in-home training of parents. And they're finding it so powerful, they're bringing all of their staff back for a second appearance. Thank you, Representative.
Dr. Jolly, I think all of us want to thank you for the work in bringing the King Tut exhibit to Minnesota. I had wanted to go to Chicago back in the mid-70s, didn't make it, and we were delighted to be able to visit the exhibit here recently. And I would encourage members to put that on your to-do list. And the folks who are watching at home, I hope that Minnesotans will turn out in droves to see this wonderful exhibit. Other questions? Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Doctor, do you know how long is the exhibit going to be here? What is our duration of time?
It's Dr. Jolly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the exhibit will be here until September 5th, Labor Day. And after that, there is no possibility of extension. All of those in charge of the custody of these are quite concerned about these artifacts and their safety in light of the current conditions in Egypt. And we do not anticipate continuing the exhibition. We do anticipate continuing the care and security of these artifacts.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, well, thank you very much, Dr. Jolly, for being here today and for your presentation and your work. Members, you're reminded about Tuesday night. We're going to the History Center, and we'll send out some additional communication about that schedule, but they're indicating that if you want to come and bring family members or others, we'll start at 5 o'clock. The official tour and whatnot will be a bit later, but we'll be forwarding that information to you. So with that, members, we're adjourned.
The next Tuesday, we're going to the Science Museum.